opening bars from what's referred to as one of the biggest, most enduring science fiction franchises of the pre-Star Wars 1970s. Of course, we're talking about Planet of the Apes, and we're delighted to launch the latest edition of the Culture Shapers podcast series, accompanying, of course, the screenings of the movies with a fantastic individual, ace guru of drama, and general all-round wonderful person, Professor Richard Hand from the University of South Wales.
Hello.
How are you, Richard?
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. So, listening to those moments, Planet of the Apes, back in the 60s, I think I saw it for the first time in the early 70s, and it is one of those movies which you almost like to think, well, it's like a Twilight Zone episode, and obviously Rod Serling wrote the screenplay, or co-wrote the original screenplay. Let's start off by considering Pierre Boulle, of course, whose book Monkey Planet was what the whole thing was based on in its own way.
That's right, yeah, that's right. Pierre Boulle, a French writer, published the novel in the early 60s. A terrific example of speculative fiction then. I mean, there are slight differences, but absolutely, you know, the genius of the idea is there already, I think, with Boulle.
We have the characters of Ulysses taken to Ape City, and the character which ultimately becomes Taylor. But Dr. Zaius is still there, Kira Zero is still there, Cornelius, the sympathetic chimps, are actually still there. And, of course, in the novel itself, although we're not going to consider that in huge sort of notions, at the end, the sequence that's framed the whole narrative reveals that the readers are indeed apes themselves, a vacationing couple of apes called Jin and Phyllis.
That's right, and I mean, that's a sort of brilliant use of fiction, you know, a terrific twist, isn't it? You realise, you know, who you've been focalised through, you know, in terms of the central characters. But you know, that's a terrific twist, but the whole sense of the irony, and that's extrapolation of an idea, you know, science fiction at its best, I think, is when it does that, isn't it?
From we started off by saying that looking at the figures alone, this was first example really of a science fiction franchise that was extraordinarily popular in the pre-Star Wars era. There were, of course, 5 movies, 4 sequels to the original Planet of the Apes, but that moment, I mean, can you recall when you first saw the film originally, Richard, and sort of how it impacted on yourself?
Yeah, I can't remember precise age I was, but I was very young, and it would have been on television in the 70s. You know, I remember it being absolutely fantastic, and it's something I watched it not that long ago with my kids, you know, and it still packs a punch, you know, there's some real quality to it. I think it's a number of factors, as you say, you know, Rod Serling, you can never go wrong with Rod, really. You know, with him sort of after Twilight Zone, but before Night Gallery, you know, an interesting time for him as a writer, even though, you know, other writers were on board as well. Not least Michael Wilson, very interesting figure, blacklisted during the McCarthy era, you know, fascinating character as a screenwriter. So there's that to it. I think one of the most powerful things, and I'm glad you began the podcast with the soundtrack. I think it's one of the most remarkable examples of film music. Jerry Goldsmith, I mean, he won an Oscar later for The Omen, didn't he, a few years later? But it is such a terrific score for the film. I think it's edgy, it's discordant, and, you know, it does send a shiver down you. And I think it's one of the great science fiction soundtracks.
We were talking with director Phil Lynas about Gattaca, and we were talking about Michael Nyman's soundtrack for that, which is much more minimalist. But we mentioned Jerry Goldsmith, clearly sandwiched between The Omen and Planet of the Apes. He composed the score for Man from U.N.C.L.E. and, of course, Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek The Motion Picture were also Goldsmith's opuses that he put together. The interesting thing you also made connected there with Michael Wilson, who was indeed blacklisted by Hollywood. Little interesting connection, he'd also written much of The Bridge on the River Kwai, which of course was the other Pierre Boulle novel.
Absolutely, the other Boulle novel that's best known to English readers, yes, yeah, absolutely. And I can't help feeling with Michael Wilson, I mean, such a talent, and yet the mood of paranoia and everything in Planet of the Apes, and I'm sure he was very well equipped. You know, given what happened to his career, you know, some years before, you know, I think it does infuse it, that sort of paranoia, that cynicism about civilization and the state, you know, all these things are implicitly suggested in the film.
If we open up with that initial sequence where we have the dialogue of Charlton Heston, obviously, is the astronaut George Taylor. In itself, many people have actually said that's an interesting take because clearly it was Herbert George Wells who talked about the time traveller. And here we have three time travellers who are kind of demonstrating through the Haslein system effect that the more they approach the speed of light, whilst they age relatively slowly, the rest of Earth, obviously, centuries are passing by. But we are introduced to a character in Taylor who is probably best described as a cynic. I think probably that's the kindest thing I can actually say. I mean, he's not the classic heroic Moses-like figure that perhaps Charlton Heston was being connected with in those days.
That's right, and I think, I mean, Charlton Heston, I mean, you know, we became aware of his own political views.
He needs the rifle. From these cold, dead hands, he'll need that
that's
rifle.
That's right, that's right. But actually, I think an absolutely fascinating film actor, and as you say, that we have the Moses, we have those, you know, the El Cid roles. But actually, that batch of science fiction films he made, you know, Omega Man, Planet of the Apes.
Soylent Green, of course.
Soylent Green, absolutely tremendous. You know, I think there was a real quality to the sort of Heston canon there. Mm. And he was absolutely perfectly cast for those, I think. And as you say, that quality, you know, he did have the chiseled jaw and all the rest and a terrific voice. But he was very good at that cynical role, that world weariness, which made him ideal, you know. And as you say, compared to, I mean, I do love the early 60s Time Machine film, but, you know, in a way, what you're getting of the late 60s in this sort of treatment of time travel, where it is cynical, it's scary, it's deeply unsettling, you know, where you think, well, maybe this endeavor was not worthwhile, you know, why are we exploring the great unknown, you know, which is an interesting kind of moment of cynicism, isn't it? Whereas in the Time Machine, I think the great scientist, the idea of pushing knowledge and the adventure is still there, even though, you know, it's a wonderfully kind of disturbing vision of a dystopia.
20th Century Fox probably had a double whammy, a double brace of successes, because clearly 1968 was when Planet of the Apes was being released, but there was that other one, 2001 A Space Odyssey, both of course being made before we'd actually landed on the moon.
That's right. I mean, that's one thing I wanted to mention. I think with any of these films, it's really important to look at the context. And I mean, what a year. I mean, what a year. I mean, for you know, social history and everything, but for cinema, yes, 2001, we've got Rosemary's Baby, we've got Night of the Living Dead, a personal favourite of mine, which I think is, you know, actually, you know, cheapo, El Cheapo budget and all the rest, but actually what it reflects about a broken society, potentially, you know, it was an incredible, and of course this side of the Atlantic, we've got If being made, and also Carry On Up the Khyber, but that's another story, isn't it?
Plus, of course, the revolution potentially in Paris, the Vietnam War, 5 years after Kennedy had been assassinated, the space race. It was a heady period of human cultural experience.
It really was, wasn't it? And, you know, it's an extraordinary period, as you say, all of those things. And, you know, you cannot help but see Vietnam reflected on the cinema screen then. You know, Vietnam, the sort of first and last televised war, effectively. You know, and so I think, you know, audiences were getting quite hardened and dispirited by what they're seeing, and you can't help but see it on the cinema screens as well.
We talked about Charlton Heston. Inevitably, we look at the casting of Roddy McDowall, but Morris Evans as well. Morris in particular, a classic Shakespearean actor. And I'm interested, Richard, in terms of your thoughts, because one of the first things that visually, after the first 26 minutes, have actually passed us by, and we think Planet of the Apes is just three astronauts wandering through a desert with strange discordant music. But there is that kind of wonderful moment where they say they find the plant, and they say, and curiously they dig it up, which I always thought was interesting. Why do they dig up the plant? But they say, well, there's one, there's another, there's another, there's another. Mm. We'll just roll back slightly, because we'd be remiss with the cultural milieu that's happening at the time, not to see the response, which I thought was really impactful, the relationship between the three astronauts of the movie, in which the flag is being planted. And the sort of sense that's there, and of course George Taylor's response to that is just to burst. He finds it absolutely hilarious that's the sort of thing that, you know, somehow we're on this planet, we think we're in Betelgeuse, we're in that sort of area, we're going to actually plant a flag.
Yes, Absolutely. And I mean, that does take us back to global politics again, I think. You know, with Vietnam, and, you know, what are we fighting for? And, you know, that sort of questioning of the state and the world. You know, that linking in with, as you say, 2001, and that, you know, the idea that space travel is on the horizon, it's in development, and yet, you know, instead of it being celebrated and a moment of wonder, a kind of cynicism about that. You know, what does it mean? What does anything mean at this point?
Taylor, Landon and Dodge, of course, being the three astronauts who survived, because as we are aware that Stewart didn't quite make it, unfortunately. She, the sole female member of the team, didn't get out of suspended animation due to a problematic aspect with that. But when the ship lands, we've got...
Just to interrupt you, Alec, I mean, I think that is a really startling moment so early in the film, isn't it? You know, I mean, I know it's not quite, you know, Janet Leigh being stabbed in the shower kind of thing in Psycho early in the 60s, but it's still... It's a shock, because you expect the astronauts to be fine and to come back in one piece and all the rest. But very early on, it's setting a sort of mood of downbeat realism, isn't it?
And, of course, at that stage, I think we'd probably just passed the tragedy that occurred with one of the Gemini astronauts, where the astronauts actually sort of died in the cockpit because they had an issue with the launch scenario. But from a filmic point of view, what a sensational use of both music and a cut, because immediately after they discover the corpse, the mummified, apparently aged corpse of Stewart, then no time to think, because, of course, the craft is actually sinking. It's sinking below the waves.
Yes. Absolutely, and you know, and it's just again all the levels of symbolism that are happening in that in what is quite a simple narrative in some ways. But for me, this is Rod Serling all over it. You know, I mean, I just think you know what he managed to do with such efficiency in the Twilight Zone, and the way he can develop a concept to feature length is really good. It's a real case study, and he doesn't do it by over cramming the narrative and everything. He's keeping it stark and simple, you know, and emblematic.
Well, it's interesting that the writer Matt Bielby had commented that the first draft that Serling had actually put in was actually rejected as being too expensive, and the reason they actually cut costs was actually by making the ape society more primitive than it had actually been in the original book.
That's right. I mean, that is one of those wonderful accidents, isn't it? Because obviously the accountants were saying we can't afford that, so they have to sort of downscale the idea, but you end up with something stronger. For me, it's, you know, it's parallel with Night of the Living Dead in the same year, where it's made on a shoestring, but thank goodness it is, because that's what makes it so haunting and so frightening, is that low budget quality to it, that it, you know, it changes the sort of B-movie forever. And then you think, yeah, thank goodness Romero didn't have millions and millions of dollars to make this, because it may have been a much less interesting film.
We've talked about directors clearly, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, Andrew Nichols' Gattaca, and so on. But let's give a mention to the director of Planet of the Apes, Franklin J. Schaffner, because he went on to make Patton, Papillon, and The Boys from Brazil. So he wasn't a slouch when it came to actually making some good narrative-themed movies.
Absolutely, yes. And, I mean, I think with all of those films, there's a sense of spectacle, isn't there? Even though, you know, a pattern in some ways so different to Planet of the Apes, and yet the way landscape looks and the way the strength of character is there, and often the choice of actors. I mean, he's working with some of the best there, isn't he? In some of their most interesting roles.
Absolutely.
You know, George C. Scott, etc. You know, really, really interesting.
And the external locations, which again were so evocative, and really, I thought, cinematically worked so well. I was fortunate enough to see Planet... It was a double bill, as far as I recall, in the mid-70s of both Planet of the Apes and Escape from Planet of the Apes. Curiously, they put the first and third movies together in a double bill, just... and I was partly expecting the TV series. This was, thankfully, at a time where that final reveal, which we haven't talked about, but it inevitably is used on the posters now, when Taylor actually has that realization as to where he is. The landscape and the deserts of Arizona, beaches around Malibu, they actually constructed the ape village around the Fox, 20th Century Fox Ranch near Los Angeles. It all added, again, I think, heightened the sense of realism that this was genuinely a different alien planet.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, I certainly, I bought into it when I first saw it, but I still do watching it. You know, I still see it as an alien planet. It's still, you know, I'm not watching it thinking, you know, we know where this is really. Not at all. And I think that's right. I think that's the achievement with what they've done. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because with Boole's original, it's much more civilized. And that's quite a challenge cinematically, perhaps, you know, to do that wonderful, you know, the ultimate kind of black joke at the end, you know, the sardonic humour of that final reveal. So, yeah, but you know, I certainly do, I sweep along. I do see it as the planet of the apes, you know, before realising where we are.
And although it's a different line and so on, but I think Burton, in trying to be more closely associated with the original book, when Tim Burton actually developed his 2001 version, even though it was actually the ninth highest grossing film of 2001, it had mixed reviews. We ended up, obviously, at the end where we see an ape like Abraham Lincoln, or ape in the Abraham Lincoln scenario, and Burton himself was quoted as saying that if there was likely to be a sequel, he'd rather throw himself out of a window than make another Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah, I wasn't happy myself with it. I mean, I think what we've got with some of these classic films is there's a simplicity to it, and you know, the latex makeup and everything in 68, actually, you know, it was a real landmark moment. But yes, what they can do with CGI and all the rest now, it doesn't make it more interesting, doesn't make it better. And I did find that the Tim Burton film was a bit sprawling, you know, lacking that efficiency of the visual and the music and the strength of an idea that we certainly get in the original.
You mentioned the music there, Richard. I think we'll take a short break as we consider the astronauts' journey through the Forbidden Zone, and then we'll talk more about the apes, the makeup, the actors, and indeed how you can still get a performance even when you've got layers of makeup to work through as well. Is it just me, or is there a sense of Bernard Herrmann-esqueness in there? I mean, you mentioned the sort of allusion to Psycho earlier, but those sort of sharp, discordant sounds.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's, you know, it's not designed to be a kind of film soundtrack that one would listen to, even though I do occasionally. Yeah. I love that kind of music. Yeah. It's arresting, it's alarming, it makes you feel uncomfortable, and I think, yes, that's the big Bernard Herrmann lesson, isn't it, in terms of what he did with Hitchcock, and of course what Herrmann did with The Twilight Zone as well, you know, his involvement there.
Indeed.
So, yeah, I mean, I just think it's consummate example of image and music. I mean, can you imagine, you know, there are a million ways to do a score for that film.
Yeah.
And, I mean, put it this way, I remember when reading about Psycho, and before Hitchcock got Bernard Herrmann on board, he was tempted to have a jazz score, have a small jazz band play. And can you imagine? I mean, no doubt, you know, there's enough in that film to make it still a landmark, but my goodness, it would be very differently perceived now. And I think the same with Planet of the Apes. I mean, getting that edgy, almost sort of Schoenberg-esque, I don't know what I'm talking about here, but
that
discordant music and everything, in terms of what we're seeing in the stark visuals, it's the stuff of nightmares, really.
And, of course, the first evidence of civilization that our three astronauts, Landon, Dodge and Taylor, encounter are scarecrows.
Yes, and the way the sound is used there, absolutely extraordinary, the awkward angle of staring up at those structures. Really tremendous, yeah.
And two wonderful quotes. Of course, blessed are the vegetarians, which is at least they're not trying to bite us, the response to that. And of course, Taylor's line that, well, if this is the best the planet can actually offer when they see a group of mute humanoids and humans, they'll be running the place within 6 months. Again, a kind of almost a colonization approach and a reference to, well, they're fairly simple, fairly basic, so if this is what they've actually got, then, you know, we'll take over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the cynicism there, I think.
In terms of dates, the actual filming for Planet of the Apes took place between May the 21st and August the 10th, 1967. So, in terms of contextualising that, so released obviously in 68, but in 67, that sort of summer of love, that was what we were saying being filmed within Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, that's and California after all, you know.
Exactly.
San Francisco is exactly. And everything, but a very different vision being created here.
Which, of course, we see referenced perfectly towards the latter part of the film where the advice that Taylor gives to the young nephew of Zira is to keep flying the flags. Which flags? The flags of dissent and so on and that sort of sense.
Absolutely.
But it takes nearly half an hour, well, 25 minutes thereabouts, before we finally get to see, in a sense, almost the money shot after a fashion, the first experience of seeing the apes on horseback.
That's right. I think that long section, though, I mean, really does establish the remoteness, the alienation, you know, all of those qualities are there, which, I mean, Serling, I'm sorry to go back to Serling, but I mean, it's something he does in the matter of seconds in The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
But he, you know, that mastery of getting the uncanny established very, very quickly. And here we have the luxury, as you say, of 25 minutes to establish that.
Yeah. And it, I can understand to a certain extent people saying, well, they couldn't do that today, they'd need to have the reveal much more sooner. But somehow the movie works because there is that commitment to say, okay, well, let's just see how it develops. So there is certainly debate and discussion between the three astronauts. There's an attempt to find out what makes people tick. And again, Taylor's line that somewhere there has to be somebody that's better or more positive than the society he's left behind.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's an interesting point about how films are made now, and, you know, of course we've touched briefly on CGI and all the rest. I mean, I went to see The Revenant, and, you know, I had issues with the film in some ways, but actually the use of landscape, the way it took its time, you know, it's not a million miles away, pardon that, but from Planet of the Apes, you know, terrific use of landscape in a way that any other medium can't quite do that. You know, a film that is at its best on the huge canvas of a cinema screen. You know, The Revenant is definitely a film, you know, not to watch on a TV screen. It's something to see on a big screen. And I think Planet of the Apes is the same. Because you get that isolation of the human figure in the alien landscape. You know, whether it's the wild frontier west in The Revenant or the desert, the uncanny desert in Planet of the Apes.
Absolutely. The hunt itself and the position of the gorillas and the lines that come through, we're listening to a little bit of the background now, it's clearly, from the astronauts' perspective, astounding to suddenly see that they're being pursued by what they would see quite clearly as aliens, but from their own perspective they'd see as apes. And then, of course, we speed through that. We see a number of sort of situations occurring. The astronauts get split up. It's not until we get to the moment where Taylor has been obviously shot and he's being fired up that we see the definite visual echoes of so much early hunter colonial discussions, where the hunters, usually from the United States or America or Northern Europe, etc., will be seen with their prizes, with their victories, and so on, and smile for camera. I think that's the moment where, if we're talking about the classic Verfremdungs effect, making strange, as analyst Darko Suvin would actually say, which is really one of the key aspects of science fiction, that's the moment where you think, whoa, these are we really are in a different environment, and it's not so much suspension of disbelief, but we're in a very much science fiction as allegory, science fiction as metaphor, possibly even SF as parable.
Absolutely, and I think it's taking a terrific concept, turning the world upside down at that moment. It's like the best of The Twilight Zone, isn't it, to serve man, episodes like that. But it's doing it with such accomplishment, I think. Mm. But yeah, you're right. It's that moment when we're beginning to piece together a picture, yep. And each turn doesn't take us to a more comfortable place at all, actually. Yep. It becomes more disturbing the more we find out, which is interesting. Again, you can't help feeling, you know, for some people that was the experience of Vietnam. You know, the longer it goes on, the more horrific it becomes.
Mm. Absolutely. So that basically is the end as far as two of the astronauts are concerned. Obviously, they both emerge in what can only be best described as cameo roles as the film proceeds, one in a museum and one effectively as a subject of brain surgery. However, Taylor, who clearly we kind of left as the sole human being who recognisably we can identify with, although we might sort of connect with Nova as well from that perspective, you have that wonderful attempt and to sort of relate to the ape society. We mentioned earlier about working through makeup, and Maurice Evans had got a wealth of Shakespearean history behind him. Clearly, makeup and the actor, it is important to get the role out because it could, and I think a lot of the concerns that the producer Arthur P. Jacobs had actually had, and remember he was also responsible for Dr. Dolittle, one of the musicals that was less successful as far as 20th Century Fox were concerned, to put it mildly. He wanted to really ensure that people wouldn't laugh at seeing effectively people dressed in gorilla outfits, you know, working through it, because we'd obviously done that, and bad science fiction films, or shall we say less challenging science fiction films, whether it's Gorilla in a Space Suit, I Married a Monster from Outer Space, that was a real danger that people would suddenly start laughing at the movie as opposed to really actually buying into it. And I think we have to acknowledge the tremendous work that Roddy McDowall, Kim Hunter, and indeed Maurice Evans and others kind of put into their roles to make their characters so believable.
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think that's the challenge. Writers like Stephen King talk about this, don't they, in terms of, you know, the zipper. And even, you know, Frank Zappa talked about the zipper from the Black Lagoon, you know, in his sort of celebration of B-movies and cheap sci-fi from the 50s. You know, if science fiction was going to continue, it had to raise its game. And I think Planet of the Apes is a tremendous example of that. As you say, I mean, the quality of the actors, I mean, Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall, absolutely fantastic. And, you know, and I think McDowall's performance is absolutely fascinating in the film, actually, because you know, just the quality of speech he has, and what he does with his eyes and all the rest. You know, he's such a tremendous performer. So absolutely brilliant casting there, I think. But yeah, I think, you know, the makeup, you know, it still works. I think, yeah, we can see how they've done it. We can see how it's been applied, and we can see that, you know, perhaps the mouths weren't quite as movable as ideally would have been and all the rest, but actually, such lovely design. And I think the whole level of costume, the whole aesthetic of the film in that way actually works as well.
Indeed, it's John Chambers, of course, responsible for the, at the time, groundbreaking prosthetic techniques that we use there. And in a strange way, inevitably, a little reference to the CGI and motion picture capture and the sort of suits that are put together in the recent incarnations of the two ape movies, which have kind of kept the franchise burning, as Andy Serkis, much beloved Gollum, of course. Somehow, I still think, if you allow for the alienness, and again, that other, the sense of the other within the apes, that actually, yes, whether you're the orangutan, whether you are the gorilla, whether you're the chimpanzee, they're still quite clearly outlined. You mentioned, obviously, the Romero work there, and I've seen critics of Planet of the Apes which have also suggested that maybe there's a kind of element of the zombie movie that comes across in the apes as well, certainly in the latter series, where we sort of see the way that society changes and how literally the world is tipped on its head.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's so interesting that it remains such a powerful franchise, I think, and the concept of it is so strong. And I think, you know, I can't remember how closely related to chimpanzees are we in our DNA, you know.
Pretty close.
Very, very close, yeah. Mm. And you know, and they're so similar and yet so different. I mean, we can go back to King Kong with this, I think, you know. the whole Beauty and the Beast kind of aspect, and the fascination, the mutual fascination between the two species, you know, and I think that's implicit here as well.
The National Film Archive of America actually selected the movie for preservation in the United States Library of Congress, which I think is an interesting line from the perspective of how culturally it is recognised as being, you know, quite a key element for the movie, and also perhaps one of the reasons for its also longevity from that point of view, the National Film Registry. It's been acclaimed as being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, and I think we'd probably agree with that, which is one of the reasons it's only Culture Shapers, which is what we're producing at present. Some of the other issues, such as science fiction as metaphor, as paradigm, talking to one or two other colleagues, they're particularly taken with the interrogation scene. We know there's that major shock within the Ape Society where you have the classic, take your hands off me, you damn dirty apes. I'm not going to do a Charlton Heston impersonation, but that line through that. We've seen him progress through the notion of saying he could write, so he could develop from that perspective. But there was, in a sense, a real connection with the thoughts of religion, society, where religion and science actually connect together, who is the dominant ideology within society, and who in the personification of Dr. Zaius actually wants to maintain the order. And as he says again, when obviously is responsible for blowing up the architectural dig that Cornelius had been responsible for, when asked about the future, I may have just saved it for you.
Absolutely, yes. I think it's interesting that the issues that it sort of touches on, and I mean, I think, as I was saying, you know, films like Night of the Living Dead do something similar, you know, and that's become more clear in hindsight, I think, you know, the status quo. 2001 as well, I think 2001 was much more polished. I mean, we could actually talk about the opening sequence of 2001 and say, well, you know, that, those are terrific apes there, but they didn't have to speak, did they? They didn't have to be, you know, attractive narrative characters. But it's such a great era, and you know, not long afterwards, films like Dirty Harry do something in a similar way, you know. Do something similar in a very different way, but they are touching on issues of ideology, and you know, we can extend that even to issues of masculinity and Americanness and so on.
Well, if we mentioned obviously Charlton Heston's biblical epics and so on, there is a way in which certainly the sequence after his trial, where he's taken to speak to Zaius, I got a sense of Pilate versus Christ in the sort of notion of, well, I don't quite know what to do with this person, but at the end of the day, they're not necessarily, you know, let's just wash our hands of the character. Let's sort of, you know, do for him from that point of view. The humiliation, I think, of Taylor during the trial, in which obviously he's disrobed, he's stripped, he kind of has to force to connect with the thing. And again, the advice that Cornelius provides him, you know, say nothing, be quiet, don't say anything, do not, you know, just accept it, be sensible. Those are kind of issues which, again, just returning back to 1960s America and possibly even the present day, do you speak out? Do you say something? Do you actually say, no, it's easier to say nothing whatsoever?
That's right. And I think, yeah, similar issues. I mean, in some ways you feel that this is not such a different time from the 60s. I think there's such a sense of division, and at the moment as we're talking, obviously there's the run-up to the American presidential election, you know, terrific spectacle.
Donald Trump as Dr. Zaius. He's got the same hairstyle. I'm only kidding.
You know, and the clash of ideologies and this sort of agonizing about what direction do we want for not just us as a nation in America, but also globally, you know, where are things heading? Mm. I mean, maybe that's one reason it's still so powerful, this film from the 60s, you know, it still taps into something, you know, there's still a raw nerve there.
Well, clearly, hugely successful comic series, books continue, movies continue, launch of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, almost deliberately designed as being prequels to the original movie, and we sort of see variations on that theme. And of course, the sign possibly of iconographic success, when you get parodies such as The Simpsons musical version of Planet of the Apes and Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius springing to mind.
Yeah.
So heaps heaps of material there which clearly demonstrate the kind of impact that the Apes movie has actually had. But as we kind of begin to draw to a closure, some of the sort of key areas within that, is it because as we approach the 50th anniversary, astonishingly, of the release of the original movie, actually a couple of years to actually go, is it something whereby that sense of the outsider and really the notion, as we've talked about, the apes, the ape society, the human society and so on, is that again something that we on a very deep rooted level, almost a Jungian archetypal level, recognize as being just critical to our understanding of who we are and what it is to be human?
Yeah, I think that's in there. And I think that, as you say, the sense of, you know, the hunter or the explorer or the gatherer, you know, who are we? Where do we come from? And I think, you know, also that you know, the challenge to perhaps orthodox religious views and everything, just by the simple concept, you know, and this is science fiction at its strongest, you know, where it can, you know, and it's not saying this is a true story at all, far from it, but it's actually positing an idea and getting us to think and question, and you know, and we have to make sense of it in that way, and I think that, you know, that's speculation at its best. Again, with some of those contemporaneous films, you know, I think 2001 Space Odyssey, you know, complete masterpiece, but it, you know, puts forward quite a sort of, it has a sort of ideology to it in some ways, and a concept that underlies that. Planet of the Apes, it fires off in all directions, and I think it's one of those that can still be quite controversial. You know, it'd be really interesting to have a round table on it, you know, people taking different angles on the film and what it does, in the same way as you can with Night of the Living Dead. You know, is it something, is it quite a reactionary film, or is it some, you know, a liberating film?
It's particularly interesting if we consider the role of the feminine in Planet of the Apes, because clearly Zira is the strongest female that we actually have there in terms of the character. Much beloved line of when Taylor sort of parts by saying, I'd like to kiss you. She said, yes, I would, but you're so damned ugly.
Yeah.
And the sense of, kind of, because the flip side, of course, is Linda Harrison's character of Nova, who is mute and is clearly the pet of bright eyes, again, in its own sort of system. Taylor is sort of finally manages to identify who he is and so on. They are really the main female characters in it, and they're well-written female characters, but again, if you're looking at real gender balance, we don't really see much more about how other characters... I suppose you could arguably say that the female ape who encounters Taylor when he's escaping in the museum when she has a child might sort of is there, but it's a cameo role at best. And of course, Stuart, as we acknowledged right at the start, she doesn't even get out of the spaceship.
Yes, that's right. I mean... I think, you know, it's very much of its time in that way, isn't there? That the lack of balance in that, you know, it's a man's world in this, or worlds. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, if you look at that era we're looking at, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West is the same year, Steve McQueen in Bullet, you know, these are the US males, aren't they?
Mm. And the alpha males as well, in many ways.
Yeah, that's right, you know, and... yeah, I mean, I think that there are challenges. As you say, that, you know, the female characters are integral to Planet of the Apes, but they are marginalised, you know, and it is the man's world vision, I think. And I suppose with other films around the same time, like Rosemary's Baby, you know, there's a central female to that, but, yes, I mean, we could analyse that for days in terms of its gender issues, you know.
I'm reminded of the Guy Haley quote in a wonderful text called Sci-Fi Chronicles, which goes, science fiction is arguably the most exciting genre of entertainment. No other form of storytelling shapes our culture, hence the name for the title of this particular series, actually, Richard, The Culture Shapers, as much or is as popular. Science fiction is a member of a group of fictional genres whose narrative drive depends upon events, technologies, societies that may be impossible, unreal, or that are depicted as occurring at some time in the future. They vary vary widely, but it does give us such a broad canvas to work upon. And that, I think, is really one of the key successes. Because we started off by considering the original novelisation by Pierre Boulle, which obviously sets the scene for this initial side of things. But then the incarnation, as you mentioned, Rod Serling, the work developed within that, that collaborative element kind of provides us with a situation which ultimately has that fantastic climax where you have to say, why put out the spoilers when Taylor actually realises that actually he never he had returned to the Earth?
I just think it's one of the most powerful endings in film. You know, it's still up there, I think. And yes, that's what infuriates me with the DVD covers and posters.
Yes,
and
it's
away.
Exactly.
I don't get it. They don't do that with Citizen Kane, do they? Or Psycho, or whatever. Well, you know, perhaps they come near to it as well. I mean, it's such a heavyweight one, and it is, as I was saying earlier, you know, I still watch it, seeing it as an alien planet, and it's, and it can still get me that ending and the full implications of that and what's happened to the Earth.
Some might say it was an even stronger ending in the sequel Beneath the Planet of the Apes, where of course there's the planet actually just literally winks out of existence, but I still think it's an interesting moot point in terms of the way it's developed. And of course we haven't mentioned the TV series, I think 14 episodes with Roddy McDowall, also in Ape Country, but as a character Galen, in which I think for probably reasons of shorthand all the humans could actually speak in the TV series, but that's a different line.
The TV series, you know, was an interesting, it was a classic spin-off idea, but what it reveals, though, is how strong the concept was. You know, even though, of course, I'd sooner watch the film again than go back into the TV series, I think, but it's the strength of an idea, and again, you know, that's science fiction at its best. You know, you create a world, you create a canvas that actually you can do a number of things with, you know, perhaps at the most trivial level as much as the richest. And I think that's what you mentioned, The Simpsons, and, you know, it's been parodied in a number of ways. I mean, it's irresistible for parody, but that in some ways can be the greatest homage to something, you know, that even people who perhaps haven't seen the film, shame on them, but, you know, they can still get it. They can still laugh at the parody of it. And that's a real testament to its worth, I think.
Indeed. Ron Harper, of course, and James Norton were the astronauts in the TV series. Ron Harper, who I always thought was quite amusing, that one of his early TV series that he'd starred in was a show called Garrison's Gorillas. It was about a World War II undercover routine. But so that's quite an interesting line on that. So, concluding question, Richard. In terms of the resonance, we've talked about the way the movie actually still shines up and holds its own very much in the 21st century. From a personal point of view, what would you say would be the definite highlight of the narrative itself? I mean, is it the reveal at the end? Is it the courtroom scene? Is it the Forbidden Zone planet? Yeah, I mean, there are so many vignettes and aspects within that, but if I was to press you, which I am doing, which one would you, or would you say, yeah, that was for me where it's a magical moment of cinema?
I think it's the beginning. I think it's those first 25 minutes. I think it's just a masterpiece of cinematography and editing and the use of music and efficient character development. And I think that, you know, I never tire of watching how it establishes this world and pushes forward. So for me, it's one of the greatest, you know, first sections of cinema.
Professor Richard Hand from the University of South Wales, absolute delight sharing some thoughts with your good self on this edition of the Culture Shapers. Hopefully it won't be too long before you're back with us and also delivering papers at the Telefantasy Society Symposium 2, which we're currently working through from that point of view. But again, many thanks, Richard, and we will keep those ape flags flying.
Absolutely.
As we said.
Thanks.